Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Windgap. There's a murder there. One of the ones missing now. Get me a story.
Bad Mama, goodness, I didn't expect you. The house is not up to par for visitors. I'm just in town on business.
What kind of person does that? Hurt a child.
Doesn't help anything. Riling folks up.
You got two mutilated girls on your hands. Someone else is doing the riling.
I didn't come back to cause any problems. Everything you do comes back on me.
Mama says I need to be careful around you.
Hello and welcome to Still Watching Sharp Objects, an unofficial podcast about the HBO series Sharp Objects. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair's sharp object Richard Lawson.
Each week we will break down the latest episode and occasionally feature interviews with people who've worked on the show itself. We're also, if you've been following along with our other Still Watching series, we did Westworld previously and the assassination of Gianni Versace. We're introducing something new in this current iteration of the podcast, which is a book reader section that will come at the very end of the episode. We will just touch on a few things that we noticed in the episode that would specifically resonate with book readers who know what's coming. So I'm hesitant to call it a spoiler section, but it's more like foreshadowing section, hints to come section at the end of the podcast. You'll have a lot of warning before we do that, though. So if you're worried about spoilers, we will not get into spoilers in the episode itself, the main part, but at the end, there might be a few spoilers lurking there.
Think about it like how everyone skips past Marc Maron's introduction to his interviews. But this will just be at the end. So you don't actually have to skip past anything. You can just stop listening to the episode.
Yeah. Just lock the gates and get on with the show. So before we get to all of that, we are going to break down the first episode of this season. Season 1, episode 1. The title is Vanish, which we find out maybe why that's the title at the very end of the episode. The director, as it will be for all these episodes, is Jean-Marc Vallée. And the credited writer is Gillian Flynn, who wrote the book also, Sharp Objects.
Now, are we a Gillian podcast or are we a Gillian podcast?
Oh, it's Gillian, right?
Yeah.
It's Gillian. Thank you. In this house, we pronounce the hard G.
Gillian, right? Jacobs, Gillian Flynn, Gillian Anderson.
All right. Gillian Jacobs. Yeah, Gillian Jacobs because her friends call her Gilly.
Right.
Gillian Flynn, Gillian Anderson. Got it. We'll never, ever make that mistake again. So yeah, before we, you know, we're going to do the same thing we always do, which is run down the episode. But Richard, before we do that, I know you watched first couple episodes and then we both just rewatched the first episode again this morning on this fine Sunday morning when we were recording. What were your thoughts on the second go around of the first episode?
I liked it. I liked it more than the first go around. I really appreciate the texture that Vallée kind of it applies to this material. You know, we talked in our little intro episode about why he kind of works for this, because it's a memory piece and he's so good with that sort of collage-y, stitched together kind of impressionistic, you know, you go in and out of time and memory and stuff. So it's a really good fit for this material. And I think that it adds an extra element to what could otherwise be a pretty straightforward mystery series. You know, I think he's adding the sort of like he's earning the Amy Adams of it.
Yeah. You know, I was reading, Hard G. Gillian Flynn gave a great interview to Megan Abbott in Vanity Fair. You guys can go read it if you want to. It's called Gillian Flynn Isn't Going to Write the Kind of Women You Want. It's a great conversation between two novelists. And they have the section there which, like, I agree with 99% of what they say in there. And then they have a section that I actually a little bit disagree with, because they were both pushing back on the notion of this HBO series being a successor of some kind to Big Little Lies. And let me quote Gillian Flynn by saying, she says, just because it has women in it does not make it Big Little Lies, which I love, by the way. But anyone who watches this hoping they're going to get Big Little Lies is going to be like, what the fuck have you sold me, Jesus Christ? I think Variety got it right when they said it's not Big Little Lies, it's True Detective. But instead of Matthew McConaughey waxing on about what it is to be a man, it's looking at what it is to be a woman. And I hope that it doesn't turn men off because it's a great detective show. So I agree with all that. Like, you know, I wouldn't want to, from like a superficial gendered point of view, to say, oh, HBO did a female-fronted show in Big Little Lies, and now they're doing one with Sharp Objects. But the Jean-Marc Vallée of it all, I think, really unites those two properties pretty closely in my mind. What do you think of that?
Yeah, no, I think that, you know, this it's not just in terms of Vallée. It's HBO. Well, I guess now there's going to be a Big Little Lies season two, but it's HBO committing to this kind of like auteur-y, not that Vallée wrote the episodes, but, you know, this kind of like singular vision for how a run of episodes should look and feel. And I like that they're going that direction. And, you know, I guess True Detective did kind of kick that off. And, but this is a much more fruitful, version of that than, say, True Detective season two.
Right. And also, you know, these are adaptations of books that, while I like both books, I think they are given, both of them were given richer texture by their HBO adaptation. Because Sharp Objects is, at the end of the day, like it's an interesting exploration of the female psyche, obviously, but it's also, you know, this is a potboiler mystery. You know, the same is true of Gone Girl. Like what happened between the page and the screen with Gone Girl, I think really, it's not like it elevated, but it really dug into the thing that Flynn does so intelligently and really highlights and underlines those things in a cinematic way, both this TV show and that Fincher film. So
yeah, and it's hard to capture the tone of a book exactly on film or on television, right? And I think that what Fincher did so brilliantly in Gone Girl was exactly that. Like, he, you know, it helped that Gillian Flynn wrote the screenplay, obviously, but like, just there's a kind of ineffable mood that you get when reading her writing, right? And these directors are able to tease it out, probably because they worked closely with the author.
Exactly. Gillian Flynn was involved very intimately in both of these things. As we said, she has a writing credit on this. We should also mention, just the last thing before we dive into the episode itself, Marty Noxon as showrunner. If you didn't listen to our preview episode, I think this is like a perfect storm of these three sensibilities of Gillian Flynn's interest in, I don't know, I don't like the word likability or hard to like or whatever, but I do like what Gillian Flynn does with that concept. So I'm just going to say hard to like women, even though that's not exactly how I feel. What Jean-Marc Vallée does with memory and trauma, and then what Marty Noxon does with like bodily harm, which is something that she's very fascinated in. Mm-hmm. And so all of those things coming together, Marty Noxon, as we mentioned, had worked on Buffy, Unreal, and this great film To the Bone, which is on Netflix, about eating disorders. And all of this coming together, I think this is like the dream creative team for this particular project. I think it's amazing. So let us start. We start with the town itself, Windgap. It's a worn out idea to say like, oh, the town, it's a character unto itself in the story, but like getting what Wind Gap is right is, I think, deeply important, because this is not a story set in New York or LA or Chicago or any of the places that we have shorthand for. This is a small, economically, in some aspects, depressed Missouri town that I think Camille at one point says there's like old money and trash, and that's it. Those are the two options in that town. So
yeah, it's a hog killing town. It's they've got processing plants, I guess. Slaughterhouses. And this is a milieu that Gillian Flynn is pretty fascinated by. She's from Missouri. Obviously Gone Girl takes place in a kind of depressed Missouri town that the characters return to after kind of a failed stint in New York. So here we have not a failed stint in New York, but a sort of failing stint in St. Louis, in our main character.
Yeah. And, in that interview that I mentioned that's in, on VF.com right now, Gillian Flynn makes no bones about the fact that Camille is based on her in some aspects. She says she showed up to set the first day and Amy Adams in costume, I presume in the black jeans and the gray sweatshirt, was wearing exactly what Gillian Flynn was wearing that day. she's like, we have a photo of ourselves side by side to prove it. So, you know, this is definitely our author proxy. Gillian Flynn was a journalist before she became a novelist and now, you know, screenwriter. And so, you know, any of this "you can't go home again" stuff is deeply personal, I think, to her. So, and then we get our first, like, we are in flashback, and this is when I got really excited about, you know, right from the jump, I got really excited about what Valet could do, because we see Sophia Lillis, who was in the film It last year, as a young version of Camille, of Amy Adams, and she's skating down a road with her sister, Marion. And we see them sneak into this house, and then they're in Camille's bedroom. And it sort of happened so quickly that I actually had to rewind because I wasn't paying enough attention the first time. I was like, wait, what just happened? Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, it's funny because in this little survey of the town, you see Bush Gore posters, a Gore whatever poster. You know, you're like, okay, so we're in the 90s. And then they go into this house and they go upstairs. And then there's an Obama poster. And you're like, wait, so when does this take place? And then you realize, oh, no, we're now in the future. And what he's used this kind of cinematic trick to sew the past into the present.
Yeah, he uses doors a lot. Like, you open a door and all of a sudden you're like in the past, in the present, whatever. Yeah, the Obama poster kind of threw me because I was like, oh, have we moved the timeline up this much? I don't know. I got bogged down in it, trying to do the mental math of like if a flashback could take place during the Obama campaign. And I'm right. Like, no, it hasn't been that long, right? And also I mistakenly thought the first time I saw it that it was supposed to denote Chicago, because in the book she's in Chicago, not St. Louis. And so I was like, oh yeah, Obama, Chicago, here we are. But no. So, and then we get this great moment where the young Camille uses a paperclip to sort of jab the present day Camille awake. And there's a lot of that too, a lot of jerking awake, falling asleep, jerking awake happening in the show. And I did point out in the note that this is a sharp object that she used.
Yeah, we are on our first sharp object. Congratulations.
It's sharp object watch. This is the first one.
Although I guess you could argue that there's a motif of a rotating fan. Those blades are sharp objects. So I don't know, man. Ooh, we are deep in the sharp objects already.
It's true. Also, I would argue the women themselves are sharp objects.
Yeah.
But yeah, the house we should mention is this insane, I believe it's a Queen Anne. I think that's the style. But it's got, you know, these like an insane turret and this huge wraparound porch. And it's like, you know, you know, hats off to the location scout who found that particular house. But we find out later in the episode that, you know, there is a dollhouse that features heavily in the plot that is based on the house. And so this idea, I think you mentioned this in our preview episode of the Krellen family living in a life-size dollhouse is sort of the feeling we're supposed to get.
Yeah, and the house is so incongruous to what we've seen of the town so far. It's like, right, you wouldn't expect there to be this like opulent sort of storybook mansion in this depressed sort of you know, forgotten Midwestern town. But I think that something that the show does interestingly, as does the book that I, from what I remember, is that like, is highlighting that there can be weird little pockets of wealth surrounded by the lack of it, you know,
right.
and what kind of stratification that creates in the community.
Something that I noticed this time, you know, like she gets this assignment from her editor, who is maybe one of my new favorite, like, on-screen editors, who, like, you know, like, we have editors, and there are editors that, like, lean into the stereotype of editors and editors that don't. But, like, I love this, like, he calls her kiddo, but then, you know, when she says no pressure, he says life is pressure, grow up. And it's like, don't you want an editor to, like, call you kiddo, but then, like, give you a tough... tough assignments and tells you you can rise to be the challenge.
If you're like listening, that. Katie. no, I think and the editor's name is Frank. He's played by Miguel Sandoval, who is this great long-term character actor who almost exclusively, I feel like, plays like Colombian drug lords. You know, he's in like Clear and Present Danger is one of the kind of main bad guys in that. And like, he's had a long career, but he doesn't often get to play this kind of character. So it's really fun to see him sort of playing not against his own type, but against the type he's normally cast in. And he does a lot of great glasses work. He's got these reading glasses that he puts on and off for effect just in this one scene. So he's really tearing into this kind of rumpled but commanding editor role. And it's a really convincing and really great table setting scene.
I love it. And I think it has a mirror in the later scene where she's talking to the chief of police. I noticed because, you know, I'm on the lookout for character names to remind myself. And I was like, oh, another desk with a name placard on it later in the episode. But anyway, and then we get like the first indication of Camille's relationship with alcohol, unhealthy relationship with alcohol, which will be made very clear by the end of this episode. But something that I didn't notice the first time I was even watching, and something I didn't even really notice that much when I was reading the book, which I just did this last month, is she's got these, you know, she's got little bottles of alcohol that she drinks and she stores, and they clink and she lines them up, and it's this whole like therapeutic thing that she does. But then she also has all this candy. And you see like this Abba Zabba wrapper, I think, when she's like packing to go home. And I was like, oh, I don't know why I hadn't put together the candy thing, because it's in the book. But it just underlines her like her stunted adolescence. You know what I mean? And the way that she drinks is like a guilty, furtive teenager more than it is like a hardened adult with a drinking problem. I mean, we see some of that like when she's in the bar and stuff like that. But a lot of times her drinks are taken sneakily.
Yeah, and she's drinking out of little, you know, airplane bottles. She's not committing to the handle of vodka, you know. So there's this kind of sense of like, well, I'm just having this one little one. Okay, not another one. You know, there's not – she does have a carton of cigarettes, which is sort of shamefully, I am a smoker, but I never buy cartons because then that means I'm going to smoke 10 packs of cigarettes, you know. So I think with her, she's like, I'm not going to buy the full bottle. I'm just going to do this. But like, obviously, the bottles add up.
Yes.
And there's an interesting thing too about the candy is that a lot of people in recovery, whether from alcohol or from opiates, they crave sweets. And so if you go to like, you know, meetings or whatever, like they have a lot of candy and stuff. And so she's kind of doing both. She's like indulging in the alcohol, but also the kind of candy afterwards. So she's dwelling in this very like conflicted place and is clearly a mess.
Definitely a mess, though her hair looks amazing. And you're right about the carton of cigarettes, but when she dumped that bag out and it was like little bottles, candy, cigarettes, Altoids, I was like, these are all things like a teen would steal, feels like to me. Mm-hmm. Maybe not the carton of cigarettes.
In a brown paper bag, like exactly, like she hides under her bed or something. Like it's very childish.
This is her trove of like indulgences. So and then we get this, so she decides to take the assignment. She decides to go home.
And the assignment is that a girl has gone missing in her hometown, and that previously, the previous year, a girl was murdered. She was strangled to death. And so Frank, the editor, is like, this could be a serial. You know, you have a personal touch to add to this story. You know, this guy in Chicago wrote this great story about his hometown. Like, this could be good for you. So she's reluctantly agrees to get in her beat up old Volvo and drive down there.
I love her Volvo, the maroon.
It's
Volvo.
So good. I don't really necessarily believe that that model of Volvo, which I believe is from the 80s, would still be running now. But like, hey, maybe they're good cars, so maybe so.
That's my favorite. Like, so many moms I knew had that Volvo in the 80s. Oh,
it's like the classic. Yeah, absolutely.
The maroon or the blue. You either had the maroon Volvo or the blue one.
Anyways, you almost wanted it to look ugly.
Yeah.
Like, that was kind of the point.
So we get a lot of flashbacks sort of seeded throughout this of, you know, like, Sophia Lillis as the young Camille in the town, and specifically, you know, on her way home to look into these, what happened to these young girls who were like essentially the age of this flashback version of her. She stops at this motel on the way. And this is a sequence that dragged for me the first time I saw it. And then I really loved the second time I saw it when I thought about it a bit more, which is, you know, she has a lot of different flashes, like the toilet triggers something for her, which we will get to later. The she sees someone in the mirror that's not her younger version of herself, it's someone else. This all has to do with a plot line, like tiny plot line from the book that I think they're going, I don't know because I haven't seen the episodes, but I think they're really going to flesh out in the season. And that is all tied to this phone, this broken phone that she keeps playing music from.
Yeah.
It's not her phone. She has a functioning phone.
It could be it could be an iPod Touch or iPhone Touch or whatever. Yeah.
It's a device with a shattered screen and a lot of music on it.
Oh, and we should mention also that Frank, the editor, says it could be good for you, you know, like shake some things off. Like there's something has happened to her recently.
Right.
Where she's like trying to get back to center or something. Right. And that's, I think, one of the projects of this 8-episode run is kind of piecing together what that is exactly.
Right. And I think this is all part of that. But she's in this motel. It's this dialogue-less sequence. She doesn't have a single line of dialogue and all this. It's all memory, drinking, and then she masturbates and it like flashes back to like a disturbing sexual, I wouldn't even call it an encounter, like awakening or whatever she had as a kid when she stumbled into this hunting cabinet where there's like disgusting drying meat and then like images, pornographic images on the wall. And it's just sort of like a nice little intro to the like carnal, lurid, you know, sexual sickness that feels like it exists in Wind Gap, you know, just the juxtaposition of those images of the drying meat and the pornography.
And the pornography is like, it's sort of a BDSM varietal. I was actually, I mean, not because I was doing this for work. I paused to see what they actually showed.
Yeah.
Like, cause you know, you're not allowed to show penetration on like regular television or whatever, even premium television. And I think it seems like the images, they sort of like fudged it, but like it's pretty graphic and it's this kind of, when I was like 11 years old, 12, I was like at my dad had business in Washington DC and I went with him. We stayed at this bed and breakfast and he went off to his meeting and I was just like at the bed and breakfast and I was looking around their shelves at this house and they had all these old National Geographics and I was like, oh, that's cool. Like, let me find more. And I opened a cabinet and it was full of these like hardcore porn magazines, like straight porn. Uh-huh. And it was like horrifying but also like alluring in a way. So I think that like that's exactly what this moment captures, the kind of sick but also seductive nature of this whole thing, which I think informs so much of adolescence, you know, like you're kind of like repulsed by something but also drawn to it. And I think you're right, the sort of sexual sickness of this town is like a pretty deft wordless illustration of a mood in these opening scenes.
Yeah, this cabin, a mood. I'm going to return to this scene and why I think it's so long and important later in the book section at the end of the episode. But the length of it really irritated me the first time I saw it. And then I felt like I understood better why it was there. So,
and there are some teenage boys who are sort of like, she kind of follows them to this cabin in a way and they're hunting. They have guns. One of them points them at her. So there's a sense of danger already brewing.
Yeah. Her as a target. And, we should say on the trend of surrealism in this show, when she's leaving St. Louis, the the road sign says last exit to change your mind. So I missed that the first time, but I don't know if we should look for other, I don't know, manipulated signs to be like inside her head. But yeah, so then we get Camille actually entering as an adult, entering Wind Gap, coming home again. One of the first things she sees is the memorial for the girls, like both the memorial for the girl who died and sort of one for the one who's missing. And she pulls up to an alleyway next to the police station. There's like missing signs on the light post. And then we get this interaction in the police station, which I love. This is her first interaction with a Wind Gap townsperson. And the girl and the woman behind the counter, I think it takes her like three questions before she asks Camille if she has kids. And it's in context of what they're talking about. They're talking about the missing girls or the missing girl. They're talking about what that does to a parent in the town, how you feel about your child and stuff like that. But this is something that Sharp Objects does really, like the book and I hope the show does really well, which is explore what it means to be like a woman to go home or to go to a place where a lot of women have followed a prescribed trajectory of marriage and kids, and to not have followed that path and the discomfort that you can feel in that situation. You know what I mean? It was just like, once again, it's in context, but it's an early question that we will, if I have, you know, if my guess is right, we will hear again and again. In this season.
And the woman she's speaking to, you know, talks about how, well, she's like, kind of like, you're lucky almost to not have kids right now, because I barely let them leave the house, you know, with some sort of predator around. You know, we let them sleep in the bed. None of us are getting any sleep, but at least we know they're safe. You know, so there's a sense of the town on lockdown.
Yeah.
And that there's a real, I mean, obvious sense of unease and no one's getting any sleep, but like, so yeah, so her kind of entering this space and wandering around it freely is sort of in stark juxtaposition to how everyone else in the town is living. So it's just kind of setting her even further apart.
Yeah. And we saw, you know, in the opening shots, which of the town, which were, I think were supposed to be flashback as well, but like, empty streets, you know what I mean? Like if someone's out there fanning themselves, you know, so you're like, okay, it's run down, it's deserted, and it's hot. Like these are all just the sense of place is so strong. And in that Gillian Flynn interview that I will keep referencing that's on VF.com, they talked about sort of a Tennessee Williams vibe, a sort of hot house. I think what Gillian Flynn said is like, you get the sense that if you left your car parked there for too long, the tendrils would overtake it and just sort of like absorb it into the town itself. So that whole thing. And I think you get that really well in this next scene, which is her, you know, meeting or reacquainting herself with the chief of police and played by Matt Craven.
Again, another character actor who's in everything and here gets a little bit more of a juicy role, which is nice.
And, you know, we see exactly what her editor said is that she can kind of or try to leverage her local angle to get more access than any other outside reporter would. She says, you know, like who she is, who her mother is, who her sister is. He has a weird reaction when she brings up her sister's name. And
he says something to her. He's like, oh, you're the one who you left or something. He kind of like trails off. And like, so obviously it's rare for someone to leave and perhaps even rare for that person to come back.
Yeah. And I think once again, I actually don't know 1,000% what he's alluding to here, but it also seems like he wanted to say something else, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You're the one who something.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
you're that sharp object.
Oh, you're that sharp object that left town. There's a lot of, you know, we mentioned this is like a hog butchering town. There's a lot of hog imagery, in, his office. He's got like this squeezy hog, but also like hog statues. It's just, you know, and he's a cop. It's all.
And you kind of imagine that it must smell a little bit.
Oh God. It looked like it reeked in there. Cause you know, like I don't, there's a way to shoot someone smoking in a room where it doesn't look like it's like cloying and disgusting. And then there's a way, you know, I think with the fan going in the window and the like sheen of sweat, you're just like, oh my God, it smells terrible in there.
And maybe some like hog smell wafting in from that fan, you know,
sure. Just like, ugh. Hog on the breeze.
Yeah, hog on the wind.
Wind gap. Welcome to We Smell Like Hog's Air. Okay.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jessie Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as a specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You can earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Then they've got this, she's got this great device. They've got this great device at the ready in this TV series, which actually she used in the book as well, even though she didn't need to. And that's the thing about Gillian Flynn is that she, because she wrote about film and television for so long for Entertainment Weekly and other outlets, like she has a really filmic sense when she writes her novels, I think. And so this device of Camille calling her editor and telling him what she found out.
Yeah.
Is good exposition. Yeah. You don't have to sit there and listen to like Vickery say anything or whatever. She's just like, this is what I've learned. And you've got a character-driven human interaction between the two of them to, you know, his concern for her, her, you know, stubborn, I can do this, whatever it is she's giving off. To like enhance it. It's not just like straight exchange of information. And like I said, like this is something that they didn't, that Gillian Flynn didn't need to do in the book. She could have just like written it out because you can write out exposition in a book and get away with it. But she did do these phone calls, which I think is just her, yeah, the way her brain works when she puts together a story. So, yes. And I like, I don't know, okay, here's where I want to check in and ask you what you think of Camille as a character and or Amy Adams' portrayal of her.
It's hard because she's so withholding, you know, and I think that in some ways the risk that HBO is taking is that like it's going to take some time to sort of get in with her. And I think that like introducing younger her is a – it helps that, you know, you're sort of immediately more sympathetic because you know that she has history and you see kind of glimpses of that history. But I think that viewers hoping for a sort of immediate connection and an immediate immersion into the story are maybe going to be a little bit alienated for a little while. And I don't want to like talk more about stuff I've seen past this episode, but like this is a slow build into both a character and a performance, but I think that what she's doing is actually really good. And it's rare that we see sort of Amy Adams in particular working in this muted, but still very expressive mode.
So they've, I think there's something about Amy Adams. And I guess maybe I would say that, okay, well, first I'll say this, that they've aged up both her character and the younger sister, Emma.
Yes.
Emma, as played by Eliza Scanlon, aged up only by a few years, I would say, probably like 3 or 4. But the Camille in the book is like in her, I think, early 30s. And Amy Adams is not. But
I think she's playing late 30s, though.
Late 30s, yeah, exactly. That's what I would say.
If we like 20-year it, you know, like – that tracks just about, you know, 20 plus years. Yeah.
Yeah. And that makes sense for like, it just, the ages make sense for all of them. I think if Amy was the first one cast and then Patricia Clarkson and Eliza Scanlon to fill out like that sort of trinity, because Patricia Clarkson's character, Adora, had, you know, Camille when she was quite young. And so that's a thing that all tracks for me, but
and Clarkson has to play both timelines.
Oh, right.
You know, so like they have to cast someone kind of in the middle. Like she's not actually really old enough, I mean, to be Amy Adams' mom, like in real life, but like it works for them. Anyway.
But the I agree with you. But the Amy Adams element that I think works interestingly in this is that she is so likable in so much of what she does. And once again, likable is not a word that I like to use that much, but like, you know, you think of some of the roles that made her big, like, Enchanted, you know, she's played a Disney princess. She can do that and she can do other things. Definitely. But like, that's, she does have this like, America's Sweetheart quality about her.
Yeah, so she grew up Mormon. She used to do dinner theater. You know, she kind of first came onto the scene as this goofy girl with braces, and you can Catch Me If You Can.
Right.
You know, and she has, so she has that, and Junebug, her breakthrough, like what she you know, was Oscar nominated for. She's this kind of guileless, sweet, you know, country bumpkin kind of person. And yet, if you look at her career, whether it's Arrival or The Fighter or you know, The Master, like she's done a lot of darker, more serious stuff, but she's still, for whatever reason, associated with Enchanted and, you know, whatever else.
Well, I was going to say that I like her in those roles. Yeah. Like in The Fighter or in Arrival was what I was thinking of in terms of like how inaccessible she is at times in that film as well.
Yeah.
You know, but like there is just an innate warmth and accessibility that even when she's playing someone as like spiky and defensive and sarcastic as she is in this show, I think you have an advantage in that it's Amy Adams doing that, you know, versus someone else. And so like I said, I'm not trying to hunt down likability. I don't need that from her, but I think accessibility, which is the sort of the word that you brought up, I think is more important. And I think she brings that even through the layers of defensiveness, you know?
Yeah, you know, and obviously, like, her best work is in her best films, which are, of course, the Batman and Superman movies, in which she plays Lois Lane and is given a ton to do, and it's really worth a five-time Oscar nominee being in them films, obviously. So if you want to see more of Amy Adams, what she really can do, go see Batman for Superman. But we'll have to settle for this for now. With this.
Yeah, this other take on journalism. Yeah. But so, and then Camille meets these roller girls. I am obsessed with the decisions that they made here. She sees them fleetingly at first, like in down that alleyway when she's going to the police station, and you don't know, maybe if you're watching the first time, you don't know if that's a memory of herself and her sister, but the long hair is what denotes the two groups of roller skating girls, and these three girls with their blonde hair, red hair, brown hair, and their roller skates, and the way that they sort of like stalk through the town is incredible. I think it's amazing. It's not in the book. This roller skating thing is not in the book. And I think it just like, first of all, whenever I see someone on roller skate, I think of the film Return to Oz and the wheelers, whatever they're called. They're terrifying. So like wheeled groups of people really scare me innately.
I think of Starlight Express. So
oh, okay, you felt, you know, joy.
That's and just how different we are.
I wonder.
But what I think is interesting about this pack of girls on their roller skates, it's a little anachronistic, you know, in a way. But also the way that their presence in the town, in this otherwise empty town, is, you know, itself an act of transgression, because again, everyone is on lockdown and like kids are not supposed to be out, but they're sort of either in defiance of their parents or their parents don't know or whatever it is. There they are sort of stalking the town, as kind of sore thumbs as Camille is, you know, but in different ways.
Yeah. I do this other podcast, Storm Spoilers, where we were like reading this book for a book club. And like, so I'm going to just shamelessly steal an observation from one of those listeners. And if you, listener, want to write into us, we are at stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. You can email us your observations. But this listener made this really interesting observation that I'm just going to keep coming back to because it kind of blew my mind, of this idea of witches and trinities in Sharp Objects. So if you take the Krellin family, you've got Adora as like the crone, even though I would never call Patricia Clarkson a crone, but like Adora is like, it's maiden mother crone, right? And so you sort of have like the Amy Adams character and then Emma, these three women. And if you look at the, just even the art for the show, just like the long hair, the in this like strawberry red family, just like what these, this trinity of women represent. But then you also have these pack of three, mm-hmm. These like weird sisters. They're also very witchy to me. And so I'm going to be on the lookout and probably be obnoxious about leaning into this theme that I think is definitely part of the text and something that I missed myself when I read it the first time.
Yeah, so there's definitely, there's a smell of Hob in the wind, but there's also some Stevie Nicks on the wind. You know, she's there somewhere. Just floating around.
Yeah. And so, yeah, and the blonde one, who we will later find out is Camille's sister, says...
Half-sister, I think, is an important designation. Yes. There. So her mother remarried, and she doesn't really know her. She's obviously aware of her and knew her as a kid, but, like, they haven't seen each other in a long time, so she wouldn't necessarily recognize her all grown up.
Yeah, which, like, slightly stretches believability, but I believe
Yeah.
it. She makes some comment later about like, mom really need, like, stop sending those Christmas cards a long time ago. So I didn't know it was you, basically. Yeah, her half sister, Marion, is also her half sister. So, you know, I guess that's where the blondiness comes in. But, the blonde Emma says, this place is so totally dead. You're like, great. And also in the woods here, Camille remembers, has a flashback to herself. Still by Sophia Lillis, but now I think supposed to be older because she's got long hair. Or maybe it's before she cut her hair off. I'm not sure. But in a cheerleading uniform, I think she's supposed to be older. Sort of running through the woods, being chased. And then we meet Chris Messina as Detective Richard Willis. What do you think of this intro to this character?
This, you know, this feels like the most... his character and even the performance a little bit like feels like the most like cop show,
yeah.
You know, aspect of this series or this episode at least, like, because it's a little bantery and he's a little sharp and he's, you know, he says he's from Kansas City, so he's like a big city cop kind of like in a small town, so he's kind of fish out of water too, which feels much more like a conventional narrative. So I'm not sure if it quite fits into the sort of the rest of the texture of the show, which is much more subtle and sort of arty, I guess, but he serves a necessary function, obviously. So we, you know, and Chris Messina is always welcome.
And we get this shot of his back, and it's just like dripping with sweat.
Yeah.
So welcome to Wind Gap. Hogs on the wind. So then we meet my favorite character of the series, yeah. Which is Jackie O'Neill, played by Elizabeth Perkins. And I guess if Chris Messina is like, looks like he wandered out of a cop show. I don't know what we think. Some gothic something is what Jackie O'Neill wandered out of. I love Elizabeth Perkins. This character, and this is no slight on her because I this is all positive. This character is grotesque in a way that I adore. Yeah. What do you think of Jackie?
Well, yeah. So Camille goes to the woods to join the search effort for right. this missing teenage girl. And she sees Jackie, who's got like a little table set up, and she's sitting in her chair drinking, making
tailgating.
A party.
Yeah,
she's tailgating. Exactly. She's tailgating a search for a missing teenage girl after yeah. another one has been murdered.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it is grotesque. But like, again, you know, talking about the sexual sickness or just the sickness in general of this town, like, yeah, maybe there would be this kind of kook who like whose entire sense of moral priority is out of whack because she's been stuck in this town forever.
Yeah, and she also alludes to something in Camille's past. She says, like, they're the same age you were, is something that she trails off that she
right.
says to her. And then Camille sort of like, you know, and she gives some exposition about Chris Messina's character, Detective Richard Willis, his marital status, single. Thanks, Jackie, for looking out, and says that she's sort of on the outs with Camille's mom. But this is so clearly an old family friend who knows Camille really well. And then we get the moment that we've all been waiting for, which is the actual introduction of Patricia Clarkson in the episode. Camille heads to the house. She does the hiding thing where she's like chewing gum, putting lipstick on, sort of hiding whatever alcohol might be on her breath. We get a flashback to her talking to her younger sister, Marion, and we get the clear sort of message from that interaction that Marion is very ill. In that scene, she talks about giving up and going to heaven and all that sort of stuff. And then, you know, she runs through the front door and then bam, Patricia Clarkson's there as Adora Krellen, the sort of the richest woman in town. All right, Richard, give me your Patty Clarkson report.
Well, you know, I love Patty Clarks. We all do. She's good. Again, you know, this we've spent now probably 25, 30 minutes with maybe not quite with Amy Adams doing this muted, small, sort of subtle performance, and then Patty Clarke swoops in her house dress and her amaretto sour, and it's just sort of like this different energy. Yeah. But like, I think the show can navigate those energies and kind of weave them together in an interesting way, because there is something kind of fable-y and fairy tale and outsize about this whole story. So like here comes the element of that, that like is going to kind of best, I don't know, clarify the sort of dimensions of the story being told, you know, like that it's not just about a sort of emotionally repressed woman. It's also about the kind of craziness around her. And I think that Patricia Clarkson as Adora is a sort of fine avatar of that craziness.
Yeah. This like femininity, you know, if Camille is some sort of rebellion against traditional femininity and her like black jeans and gray sweatshirt, then Adora is just leaning hard into it, where like everything is pink and perfect.
But she has an edge to her. I mean, she's not that happy to see her daughter.
No.
She's sort of like, well, the house isn't, you know, it's too messy for guests or whatever. Like kind of referring to her daughter as a guest, which is, you know, a little bit cold.
Right.
So yeah, there's obviously a tension between them. Adora clearly is somebody who wants to be seen one way, but actually behind closed doors behaves another. You know, that's established pretty quickly in this intro scene.
Yeah. And, we get this, the intro also of Alan, her husband, and, you know, just underlining what you said about him being Camille's stepfather. He's like, Camille who?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. This child I helped raise. Right. And then we get this funny thing that's not in the book and just really kind of cracks me up, which is like Alan's stereo system, which is this like space age, like deeply just looks so out of place.
I believe we would call it a hi-fi.
Oh, the hi-fi.
You know, right? Like it's like it's old timey like sound system that he's clearly obsessed with, because we see him attending to it very often.
Is it old-timey? Because it's got like these like bright neon lights on it.
Well, like, it's not old-timey in that like in the technology, but like that anyone would have a sort of obsess over their sound system in their home. It just like doesn't everyone just play everything on the thing, you know? Like it just it feels like again an anachronistic sort of obsession.
But it's it made me want, because it's not in the book. Like, first of all, I'm glad that Alan has this like sort of hobby. It sort of helps coalesce his character a bit more for me. But like also, it makes me, between this and Big Little Lies, it really makes me think about Jean-Marc Vallée's like how obsessive he might be about his music. Because like in Big Little Lies, both Adam Scott's character, I think, and then certainly the like Reese Witherspoon's daughter's character were like obsessed with music, right? And always playing like really good music.
Yeah.
And in this, we've got the device that Amy Adams is constantly using to listen to music. And then we've got Alan's hi-fi. And like either Jean-Marc Vallée himself is this kind of person that he's obsessed with music, or this is his fun trick of getting music in a diegetic way into the episodes, you know. But either way, yeah. I was like, this is another little Big Little Lies thread for me, where I'm like, oh, we're gonna have fun with this soundtrack. This is gonna be really fun, I think. So and there's this one shot, you know, Camille goes upstairs to her room. this is the most relatable "you can't go home again" thing for me, is she checks her phone and it's like 8:30. Like everything.
Jesus God. Like, yeah.
She's like, get me out of here. It's 8:30. What the hell? So she sneaks out. Once again, that sort of like teenage, guilty teenage sneaking that she does. But as she leaves, like, Alan's still messing with his radio. But if you, there's like just one quick shot of Adora like dancing. Yep.
Just doing her thing on a whatever Tuesday night or whatever.
It is. Yeah, 8:30 on a Tuesday. Just like, yeah. she's Stevie Nixing out a little bit herself. Anyway, so there appears to be one bar in town, Censors, and this is where Camille goes to get her more adult fix of alcohol. The owner is someone that she knew as a kid. He bought it from a gay couple, and
it's implied. He never says it explicitly. He's like, but you know, they moved to California. We don't get many of their type or whatever. Like, clearly, he bought it from a gay couple.
Yeah. Well, like, my favorite part, I mean, so it's meant to highlight like his shitty regressive thinking and her, like, you know, big city St. Louis. Like, she makes some jokes because he's like, they would eat that one up. And he points to
the twink in the corner.
John Keane, who's the brother of the girl who's missing.
Yeah.
And so then Camille calls him gay bait. But she's like, oh, yeah, they're always recruiting. And he's like, uh-huh. Okay, fair enough. All right. And then she's sort of like thinking about going to talk to this guy because she's like trying to do her job and interview people. And this is where the detective steps in. He's trying to like kind of flirt with her. She's being very sharp object with him.
He's also running interference, though.
But also that. Yeah. He says you're not allowed to talk to a kid without their, you know, parents. So it's a – I don't know.
Which I don't think is actually true of reporters.
Yeah, right? I don't know.
Like, police can't.
We as reporters are like, I'm not sure.
I interviewed teenagers once at VidCon, but their parents were there. And I guess I did ask permission.
Yeah.
But anyway.
I'll just say that it's never come up for me. So
you're not interviewing teens on the street about Game of Thrones?
Or they're like dead or missing sisters or anything like that. So, yeah. And so Camille drinks too much, stays too late, sleeps in her car.
Well, it's one of those great
cuts,
pricked awake things because she's like really headbanging to music. And then all of a sudden it's her head, you know, kind of dropping down and she's awake, you know, and it's like early morning. Like, not quite bright out, but, like, it's a really great cut.
It's so good. And so she sneaks him back home, and she lies, once again, like a guilty teenager, and says, like, lies and says she was getting something out of her car. And this is where we get exactly what you were saying, like, this underline of, like, Adora not, like, the appearance, how important appearance is to Adora and how not nice she is about it, how everything is about her. I think the detail in the scene that really drove all of what Adora is home for me is the height of the heels she's wearing in her dressing gown at breakfast. Yeah. Like, that's.
Yeah, totally. And she says, so Amy Adams is like, I'm not a kid. And she's like, well, while you're here, you are. Because, like, everything you do here reflects on me. You know, this kind of infantilized world that Adora has built in this little, in this big dollhouse that we'll get more of as the series progresses, a sense of that. It just establishes a dynamic that is clearly not good.
And then we get her breaking down and graduating to a larger bottle of vodka. She's going to need a bigger bottle of vodka to get through this town. Yeah. And there's a great shot of the clerk just checking his watch for like how early it is that she's buying that bottle of vodka. And she heads over to the Nash house. And Nash is the first kid who went missing. We see her swigging Listerine to cover the alcohol in her breath as she walks into this. And I really liked this scene because I love Will Chase, who plays Bob Nash. You're way more of, because like Will Chase of Smash and Nashville fame.
You can stop at Smash. Okay. Just stop. Just Will Chase of Smash. Smash is Will Chase.
Smashes
Deborah Messing in Smash.
Is he a – he's a Broadway guy too, though, right?
Yeah. He did – he was Roger in Rent a time. He did Miss Saigon, Full Monty, Aida. He's been around. Now he's kind of as so many Broadway actors do, he's now doing television, which is fine. He's got to earn a living. But yeah, it's an interesting role for him because, you know, even in Smash, like he was playing, you know, it was a little lighter. And this is like small town serious, no hint of any musicality about him at all.
So I don't think we're going to see a musical number for him.
Well, I'm not going to say anything. I've seen further episodes than you have, but I'm just not going to say anything. Yeah, he bops out to the hi-fi at the
right. He and Alan get down.
Yeah.
I thought he was great in this, Bob Nash, as like if we're following the classic murder mystery sort of you know tropes, you know the parents or the father, usually the young child, are always under suspicion, right? So he's immediately a suspect to us, those of us who've seen mystery shows before, right? And I think he really rises to that because he's not like so overtly creepy or anything like that that you're like, oh, it's definitely him or it's definitely not him because he's too creepy. But it's the way he talks to his younger daughter who comes in and he talks about like her chart. There's just like enough hints of creepiness and defensiveness that it's, I think, really works.
Made me think of you know Paradise Lost, the documentary series about the kids from West Memphis.
I thought you were gonna talk about Milton right now, and I was like, all right.
Hell no. I was an English major, but I don't know any shit about that. All right. The West Memphis Three, you know, who were convicted of this murdering these kids, and then it's clear they didn't do it. They've since been let out of prison, although they had to do an Alfred's plea. And anyway, but suspicion now pretty heavily falls on one of the fathers. And so it just kind of like the setting and everything kind of just reminded me of that. It's like that maybe the perpetrator is the closest, you know, man to the perpetrated, I guess.
Having watched enough Law and Order Criminal Intent, only the Vincent D'Onofrio episodes, I can confidently say that it's always the boyfriend is a phrase that's used a lot in procedurals.
That's right. Yeah.
It's always the dad or the boyfriend or the brother, I guess, perhaps. Bob Nash says a fun thing. He says, am I going to use this word? Yeah, I'm going to use it.
Yeah, go for it. I give you permission.
Thanks. He said, faggot did it because he didn't rape her. And this is just like another delightful flavor of what this town thinks of gay people, but also it's an important detail of the case, which is that these women, this young girl, this one young girl was not sexually assaulted, which is rare, I think, the point for a murder. So whoever did it was not, you know, whatever their interests were, it was not sexual necessarily or traditionally sexual. So, okay. Then we get another download from Camille to her editor. I don't know what to make of this. He's coughing, and I'm just going to say that, like, whenever a character's coughing,
it's not good.
It's not good. I wrote, I do not like that in all caps in my show notes here.
And he's not supposed to be smoking, but he is. And, like, the wife is kind of like, you know, like, grumbling at him. It makes me nervous because I like the character. But the cough,
she's also,
right?
She says you'd better be right. And I also think she's just talking about Camille. And it's like this, his wife says that. And it's like this, you know, he genuinely does think this would be good for her. And his wife seems to be skeptical that Camille can survive this return home. Is sort of what I was reading into that. And then we see, I just started calling them the Roller Girls. We see the Roller Girls and some teen boys messing with the memorial. John Keen, sort of, the gay bait from the bar is looking morosely on as they desecrate the memorial to his sister of some sorts.
He is played by Taylor John Smith, who has another Hollywood redhead connection in that he was ostensibly the lead character in a movie called Wolves, written and directed by Bart Freundlich, who is Julianne Moore's husband.
Whoa.
Yeah.
The Ginger Network is super strong.
It really is.
But he's on the scene when they discover his sister's body. His sister, Natalie Keene, is found in the alleyway. And the way that it's shot, You know, you hear the scream in the alleyway. It's the alleyway next to the police station where we've been before.
It's very abrupt. All of a sudden, we're just like discovering a body.
Yeah, there's a scream, and then like Camille starts running. The roller girls head that way, and John Keane stays exactly where he is, and the camera is shot over his shoulder, so it's like his shoulders in frame as you see these people like running towards the body, and he never goes to the alley. Like, you don't see him react to the body, and so this is the discovery of the second body. So this is officially like a serial murder. We see some blood around the mouth of this like terrible, gruesome corpse.
It almost looks like her teeth have been taken out. Or am I wrong?
It does almost look like her teeth were taken out. Yeah. I don't think it's overtly stated, but okay. Yeah. And then we cut to the interrogation room where Richard, I call him Detective Dick. This is what I got used to calling him when I was reading the book. I don't even think it's like what he's called in the book. I just sort of calling him that.
Referred in the book, isn't it?
Sorry?
Detective Dick is used as a term in the book, right?
I think so. Anyway, yeah. I'm just going to start calling him that because it's fun to say.
Yeah.
He, you know, he was sort of lecturing Camille in professionality before, but he has brought her some Jack Daniels into the interrogation room and is really trying to drive her home. And she's really not having it. And she's trying to get info. And he then high roads her and is like, let's save the games until at least the kid's in the morgue or something like that. And he leaves and she drinks her whiskey and his whiskey, which is, I don't know what I would do probably if I saw a teen girl in an alleyway. And then we cut to Adora pulling her eyelashes out. This is like, we get multiple shots of this in the episode. What do you think of this part?
Well, it just, you know, obviously Camille has her tics, let's say, her little idiosyncrasies. And clearly she inherited some of that nervous energy from her mom, who is pulling her eyelashes out, which is a nervous tic that a lot of people have. I think there's a term for it, actually. People pull out their eyelashes and their eyebrows. Kind of compulsively. So again, there is a sort of, not that there's a, that's a dark thing inherently, but there's a unrest, a disquiet, lurking beneath this kind of polished surface of Adora.
It's a trichotillomania.
Thank you.
Yeah. And, it's just one more sort of like bodily, you know, we talked about Marnie Noxon and her fascination sort of like with the body. It's just like one more sort of like bodily thing that's like, it's unsettling to watch, I will say, at least. Not the act of it, but the compulsive nature of it. You know what I mean? So, and then we meet Emma for real. Emma comes down, or Emma for fake, probably.
Yeah, looking very different than she has on the street.
Mm-hmm, literal ribbon in her hair.
Yeah.
Says she didn't introduce herself because she says, I can be shy, I guess. I mean, I really love what Eliza Scanlon does with this entrance, with this role, which could be so unnatural and weird. And she does, like, it's a little creepy, as it should be, but like, I don't know. I just love the blend of like sweetness and creep to her. Full disclosure, I should say Eliza Scanlon is our Vanity's star in the August issue of Vanity Fair. So you can read her interview with our very own Krista Smith on VF.com right now, or in the magazine itself. But I think this is great casting. She's Australian. Not that that has anything to do with it, but I really love her in this role. I also love the design between her in sort of what she calls her civvies, her roller girl mode, and this. It's not like so like slutty and trampy or anything like that. It's just sort of like, it's just like wild, you know, like when Camille sees her and she flashes in a helpful way to the audience to be like, ah, this is the girl in the roller skates I met earlier. She's wearing a flowered tank top in that earlier scene too. So it's not like completely off the mark of what she looks like here in her doll mode, but it's like, so it's connected, but it's different enough. And I like those juxtapositions. So, and then we get to see her dollhouse, which is this perfect replica of the Queen Anne.
And then Toni Collette runs in and starts screaming and screaming. And yeah, it's a Hereditary scene all over again.
That's a Hereditary joke that I don't get because I haven't seen the movie.
Oh, you haven't? Toni Collette's character makes these like little replicas of her home. And so it's a doll. She makes dollhouses essentially, but like as an art project. So there's a lot of creepy dollhouses happening this season.
Is there an uncreepy dollhouse like in out there in the world? Aren't they all creepy?
Yes, in my home, in my bedroom.
Your personal dollhouse.
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Million little Ben Barneses.
And we just get this like interaction between the sisters. We get this further information about Marion, who like died as a child. We get a flashback to the funeral of young Camille, sort of trying to rub the lipstick off of her dead sister's corpse and being pulled out screaming, and all of this stuff, and the idea that her room is being kept as a museum to her. It's all very, very creepy, in a really I think engrossing way. Well done. I'm just gonna keep saying it, just what Jean-Marc Vallée does with almost wordless memory,
yeah,
to convey things. We don't have to, you know, Emma does say that Marion died and all of that, that's obvious, but like what Camille felt around that is not something that the adult Camille is going to convey to us at all. We can only get it from the memories inside of her head, you know?
Yeah.
So, all right. And then last thing, Camille takes a bath, drinking vodka, and she gets in the back and a bath, and there's listening to that music on that device, and there's scarring on her body. And we see one scar in particular on her forearm. It says the word vanish, which is the name of the episode.
Yeah.
So, what do you want to say about
that? She's been using some sharp objects, I think, on her person.
It does look like she's been using some sharp objects on herself for a long time, given the nature of the scars. So
yeah, and pretty extensively. And I don't remember much of the book, but I do remember this sort of the word motif that she had carved various words on herself, and that always felt like a little like a literary gimmicky kind of thing. So I'll be curious to see how that sort of functions in the show, if it does at all. It's a good reveal. You know, if anyone was wondering why she's wearing full pants, full sweatshirt, you know, heat up to her wrist in that hog heat.
I was about to say hog heat.
Hog so heat. The name of the episode should have been Hog Heat. Or the show, actually. Amy Adams in Hog Heat. You know, so here's why. Because she's literally got things to cover up about herself.
She has literal scars from her childhood on her body. Yeah. There is like this very literal, like on the nose aspect to this cutting that, I don't know. I'm interested when I brought up this book for this book club I was doing, I didn't know about the cutting. I had some people like mention that perhaps I should have given a trigger warning about it. And I didn't, I didn't know it was a part of the story. It's actually not revealed until like, I would say a quarter of the way into the book. And so the fact that they did it at the end of the episode, I think they kind of had to, just because like, I think it's something, you know, the same is true of the Emma reveal. The Emma reveal, like she manages to not actually meet her sister as her sister until further on in the book as well. And so I think those are two things they sort of had to do in the first episode, because there's no way people weren't going to like talk about it in the discussion around the episode. So I think it had to come at the end of episode one, but I don't know. It's interesting. Like I've seen some TV critics on Twitter sort of talk about the trigger warning of it, but HBO, I think, in trying to hold back the reveal, does not, you know, sort of mention anything at the front of the episode, I think, about self-harm, at least not in the screeners we got that could be different in the broadcast version. But so this is definitely a thing. I do think it's a thing that's done for a reason, not just for shock value. And something that I do like is that it sort of, I think when you first meet Camille in the book and in the show, you're like, oh, great, another, you know, alcoholic, you know, detective-esque character. We've never seen one of those before. But when you find out that the alcohol is really her trying to numb this other thing about her. And this is sort of helps us understand some of the references made to recovery possibly earlier in the episode. Like, mm-hmm. how is she in recovery but still drinking? This would be why, because it's a different kind of damage on her. So, all right. We are running long, so I'm just going to like keep this like little book reader section at the end short. But this is where we are going to talk about some book reader stuff. Before we get to that, though, let me just quickly say, Richard, where can people find your work if they don't want to listen to this next part?
Oh, Ryla's on Twitter and VF.com. Yeah, that's it for right now.
Yeah, I am also on VF.com and at Joe Wrote This on Twitter. Once again, you can email us at stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. This is where I am going to talk about some book stuff, so please feel free to turn off the episode, and hopefully we will see you next week. All right, for those book readers still listening, I just want to mention a few things. The flash of the dirty trunk on the car, like it says dirty in the dust on the trunk of her Volvo, I really liked, because that is both like A, of course, something you would do to a rundown Volvo, but B, a little foreshadowing of the words that she writes on her body. So I just thought that that mm-hmm. was real interesting. The inclusion of Jackie saying you were the same age makes me think that the sexual assault aspect, which is weirdly glossed in the book, that Camille was sexually assaulted as a teen, is like super glossed over in the book. I think that's definitely going to get much more of a treatment in this.
All the stuff with the boys chasing her and, you know, especially when she's in the cheerleading uniform and you think that she's actually running scared. But then she kind of turns around and smiles a little bit. Like, I think the show is clearly building to that in a way that you're right. The book that I remember of the book, it didn't.
Rich and I talked a little bit off air about like how is this book, which is actually pretty slight in terms of length, going to be expanded to 8 episodes of television. And there are ways in which there's like slow build going on, but there are also ways in which I think some stories are going to be fleshed out. That's one, and then the other is. I believe, and once again, this is not a spoiler because I haven't seen the further episodes, but I believe based on like stuff in the trailer and stuff we learned in this episode, that her time in the like institution and specifically her relationship with her roommate there is going to be a big part of it. Her roommate in the book kills herself, and that's once again a fleeting mention. But this idea of Camille having like lost her sister and then maybe losing this figure who is probably sister-like to her. And I imagine this is definitely her music that she's listening to and all sort of stuff like that. Like, I think that's who she saw in the mirror in the motel. So I think that like roommate character who is barely mentioned in the book is going to become like an important figure in these 8 episodes. Camille jokingly in the bar when Detective Dick tries to block her from talking to John, she says, Jesus, I was just going to hand on him. They do have a relationship in the book. So that's like a nice little seed for book readers. And then the last thing is the masturbation scene. I was watching it. I don't recall it being the book. And I was watching it and I was like trying to figure out why this is so important and what I figured out the second time I watched it is that because of the scarring on her body that she's done to herself after her sexual assault, we'll say, she doesn't have sex. This is a character who doesn't have sex because she doesn't let people see her body. And so her relationship with sex, she's like all but celibate basically. And so her relationship with sex like is masturbation. That's it. And so like that idea hadn't really hit home for me, and I don't think the book really goes into it, but I was like, okay, this is like an important thing time for her because it's like the closest she gets to having sex. So, and she does it like fully covered and under the covers and all that sort of stuff. Like, she's just so disassociated from her body generally that and that there's that great shot while she's doing it where she like looks into the reflection of the lamp and she's all distorted and stuff like that. So I don't know. I'm interested to see where all of that goes. Yeah. Camille's relationship with her body and with sex. And
I forgot that she had a relationship with John in the book. I didn't.
Oh, sorry. Spoiler.
No, it's fine. I mean, I read the book at some point, but
yeah, I wouldn't call it like a relationship, but they have a,
that's right. 'Cause she walks up to him and she goes, you're a sharp object, aren't you? Right.
Right. He's like, you're a sharp object too.
Yeah,
let's be sharp together.
Let's bang him together. Yeah.
So, yeah, those are all things. Overall, the second time through, I really, really liked this episode. And I really, really like what so far, what they're adding, what they're keeping, what they're maybe sort of sliding over. And I'm excited. I'm really excited to talk about this with you every week.
Yeah. Richard, so. It's going to be good. It'll take us through the summer.
Yes. Through that, the hog heat of summer.
I might even have to do one from Alaska. I mean, because I've got plans this summer. So,
All right.
I hope you'll stick with us because, you know, if we're just doing it for ourselves, we could just do that over GChat. So.
All right. Well, once again, you can email us stillwatchingpod@gmail.com if you have any sort of observations, if you're in this section, I guess you would send us guesses about the murderer because you know who the murderer is. And we will see you, sharp objects.
Hi, I'm Michael Calori, the co-host of Wired's Gadget Lab.
And I'm Lauren Good, the other co-host of Wired's Gadget Lab. Get ready to dive deep into the cultural phenomenon that's been shaping conversations, sparking movements, and breaking barriers for over a decade.
The new three-part docuseries, Black Twitter, A People's History, based on the groundbreaking Wired cover story by Jason Parham, explores everything from the fun, games, and inside jokes that characterize the early years of Black Twitter to the social movements, the voices and the hashtags that made Black Twitter an influential force in nearly every aspect of American political culture. Join us as we unravel the threads of this digital community, tracing its origins, celebrating its triumphs, and exploring its impact on society at large.
Watch the series from Onyx Collective in association with Wired Studios, premiering on Hulu on May 9th.
From PRX.